The U.S. Peace Corps was active in South Korea between 1961 and 1981. One of the many volunteers who served in South Korea was KAI President and CEO Kathleen Stevens. It was the beginning of her long relationship with South Korea that would eventually lead her to become U.S. Ambassador to the country in 2008. In this episode, we look back on her first visit to South Korea. This interview was conducted by Tyler Lloyd, who runs the wonderful podcast series My Peace Corps Story, which you can find on iTunes. The episode is a little longer than the usual Korean Context episode, but it is highly informative and worth every minute. Korean Context is also going to go on break. We'll be back in the fall with great new content. With no further delay, here is Tyler Lloyd interviewing Ambassador Kathleen Stevens.
Peace Corps gives us a chance to show a side of our country which is too often submerged. Our desire to live in peace. Our desire to be of help. There can be no greater service to our country, and no source of pride more real than to be a member of the Peace Corps of the United States.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the My Peace Corps Story podcast. I'm your host, Tyler Lloyd, and I'm here to help tell the stories of current and returned Peace Corps volunteers. If you like what you hear today, be sure to connect with me over on Instagram at My Peace Corps Story, on Facebook by searching for My Peace Corps Story, and as always, over at MyPeaceCorpsStory.com. On this week's episode, I am pleased to have former Ambassador Kathleen Stevens. She served as the United States Ambassador to South Korea, but her first time in South Korea was as a Peace Corps volunteer from 1975 to 1977. That was all where it started. But you may be thinking, Peace Corps in South Korea? South Korea is one of the most developed nations on the planet. Well, that was not the case in the 70s when she served. We talk about how her service impacted her, her career, and much more. For those interested in the Peace Corps, international development, and diplomacy, this is an episode that will not disappoint. Without further ado, this is the My Peace Corps Story podcast.
My Peace Corps Story.
I'm Kathleen Stevens. This is My Peace Corps Story.
Hey, Ambassador Kathleen Stevens. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
Now, should I address you as Ambassador?
No, you don't need to. I'm not an ambassador anymore. You can call me Kathy.
Okay, Kathy. Well, what a pleasure to talk to you about your Peace Corps service and everything that's happened since then, your career trajectory. And you were a volunteer in South Korea, which probably most people listening to this podcast don't know that we ever had volunteers in South Korea. When they think of South Korea, they think of mega cities, K-pop, all this culture. And why would we ever have Peace Corps volunteers in South Korea? So I'm very interested to hear all about your service, what exactly you were doing. So I'm excited.
Oh, well, thank you. It's always a pleasure for me to reflect on Korea's journey, my journey. I guess one of the, you're making me feel very old, but one of the things that's kind of nice about getting older, especially in a place like Korea, I mean, to really have been able to see within my own experience, my own lifetime in such a vivid way, this extraordinary journey, which is not finished, but something that obviously as really, as any Peace Corps experience does, shaped my life in some really profound ways. And I've circled back to it time and again, it being Korea, thinking about U.S.-Korea relations in particular. But what I call, for lack of anything else, Korea's journey.
Mm-hmm. And if the internet told me the truth, you studied East Asian studies. So you were interested in Asia. When you applied to the Peace Corps, was that the goal to go to Asia, or did you want to go just anywhere you were up for?
Yeah,
anywhere.
I mean, it was to go to Asia. So just to back up a little bit, I was in Korea as a Peace Corps volunteer from 1975 until 1977. You mentioned earlier that probably most people are not even aware or think about Peace Corps being in South Korea, but in fact, it opened a program there in 1966, and it was there until 1981. Some of this I've learned after I was a volunteer and as I returned to Korea as ambassador, and many people ask me about the Peace Corps in Korea, so I learned a lot about it, so I can give you a lot of facts and figures. But if you want to focus on my own experience. I had gotten interested in China in particular and East Asia while I was in college. I was going to college in the 1970s when the Vietnam War was raging. I was also in college at a time when Nixon had gone to China to begin to open relations with a country, the People's Republic of China, with whom we had not had relations for several decades. And I had a great professor in college who kind of just opened me up to the broader world of thinking about Asia and thinking about the world. I grew up in Arizona. I'd never been east, I was like, save the Mississippi River. And actually, before I went into the Peace Corps, I spent a year abroad, which was a little more unusual in those days.
Yeah.
And what was really unusual is I didn't go to Europe. I went to Hong Kong. So Hong Kong, for me, a girl from Arizona, was kind of like, we talk about even now, I mean, young people from the heartland going to New York. Well, I went to Hong Kong and spent about a year and a half there. Mm-hmm. And it really kind of gave me the international bug. That was my entree. I came back from Hong Kong, got my degree, thought, what now? We were in a recession. Thought about grad school. Went up to Montana, where I had a brother who was living and working as a forester. And he had just been accepted to be in the Peace Corps in Nepal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first time I had never thought about the Peace Corps. And for various reasons, he didn't go. But it gave me the idea. So I just applied to the Peace Corps and I said, yes, I'd like to go to Asia. But even I didn't think about Korea as a Peace Corps country. I thought about Southeast Asia. But when I got the invitation to go to Korea, it kind of made sense. And in kind of an intellectual way, I was interested in the greater Chinese cultural sphere, which historically mm-hmm. included, you know, Korea in terms of its influence and relationships. And it was a place where I could learn a new language, where you could use Chinese characters, although I found out knowing Chinese characters, I didn't know them very well. It's kind of like maybe knowing Latin and thinking that's going to help you in English. It mm-hmm. kind of does and kind of doesn't.
As a student of Latin, that analogy works very, very well for me.
You can sound very smart at times, and at
yes.
the other times you wouldn't be able to, you know, get a glass of milk. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you got your invitation to serve in Korea, what did your family think? Because at the time, it was 22 years after the end of the Korean War that you were going to a country. Did that play into any of your perceptions or your family's perceptions of where you were going?
I suppose to some extent it did. I mean, I remember the other thing that was happening and I, you know, so long ago in 1975 as I then got the invitation and was getting ready to go to Korea. And again, it seems like at least things moved a little more slowly in those days. I got my information through snail mail and mm-hmm. occasionally an 800 number if I could reach somebody in Washington to find out what was being planned. But in the spring of 1975, of course, came the complete U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam and the reunification of Vietnam under North Vietnamese rule.
Mm-hmm.
This had a big impact in Korea in terms of their own sense of insecurity. I didn't know all about all of that at that time, but I'm just trying to kind of set the political mood in the United mm-hmm. States of what I remember being really important that year as I was getting ready to go. I think my own family, since I'd gone to Hong Kong and I'd come back, I think they were kind of resigned to the fact that I was going to go off someplace else. And mm-hmm. I was raised in a very sort of, you know, independent Arizona tradition, I suppose. So in a way that now I have to say as a parent myself is probably a little bit hard to imagine. And I think they pretty much thought, well, you know, it's a program that's kind of more organized. I mean, she's not going off to, which I also done a bit of a backpack around. So so go for it. But in terms of Korea itself, you know, in those days, again, the impressions of South Korea and the United States were shaped by a television program called MASH, which, mm-hmm. again, I think the generation of people I hope are listening to this probably don't even know about unless you're,
I know MASH.
Okay.
MASH is excellent.
It's a great program.
I watch reruns, of course, but still
right.
phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it kind of drove, I learned later, South Koreans crazy at the time because it wasn't the image of their country. They thought they were very image conscious.
Mm-hmm.
There were some scandals actually in the 70s in Washington, which we knew about dimly, having to do with South Korean efforts at influence buying on Capitol Hill. They were very worried about abandonment, actually. And forgive me for always getting into policy, but I'm obviously colored by the years and years afterwards when I have looked at U.S.-Korea relations. But looking back, I realize all those things were kind of part of how we saw mm-hmm. each other. So I think people just thought of Korea, if they thought about it at all, as a place where we had troops still. Vietnam had fallen, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
In Korea, there was some insecurity and that was being played out sometimes in some pretty counterproductive things they were trying to do in the United States. But you know, there wasn't a Korean community here, and certainly not where I live. And even in a place like LA, it's probably hard to imagine, but there was very small Korean community. So I don't think people had any particular impression at all other than that, yeah, there was a Korean War, and then there was an armistice. Mm-hmm. I had an uncle who had fought in it. You know, I met many people actually who have, part of that generation, but they didn't talk about it very much. It had been kind of, you know, the Korean War used to be called the Forgotten War, mm-hmm. to the extent that, you know, my father and uncles and others of their generation talked about their military service. They talked about World War II. They didn't talk very much about Korea.
Okay. And you've been accepted to go serve in Korea. What exactly was your assignment? Were you an education volunteer, teacher? What were you going to be doing in Korea?
I was an education volunteer. I was in the 35th group, K-35, and there were about 30-odd of us recruited for that program. It was designed to be a teacher training program. Mm-hmm. Koreans were very enthusiastic about education. That hasn't changed. We're really trying to strengthen their education, especially their English education. It's the low-hanging fruit, right, for those of us who maybe don't have liberal arts graduates, who don't have many other skills to go and to teach in Korean schools. So I was assigned to, as we all were, to a middle school program, which means junior high school students. Mm-hmm. And all of us, almost all of us, were assigned to places outside of major cities, and all of us outside of Seoul. This is a little different from earlier Peace Corps programs because they had placed Peace Corps volunteers in the universities, in the major cities, for a variety of reasons, mostly actually political. There was at that time and continued to be sufficient sort of student unrest, and the political situation, which was more or less martial law, mm-hmm. Was such that Peace Corps volunteers kept doing what Peace Corps volunteers aren't supposed to do, right, then or now, getting involved in politics. Mm-hmm. And so the university assignment sort of stopped. And it turned out that in Korean high schools, all Korean students do is study for an exam. And some young foreigner whose only qualification is being a native speaker of English turns out not to be very good at teaching to the exam. Mm-hmm. So we delightfully were put in these schools that almost all of them were single-sex schools. So I was in a boys' middle school. There was a post-Korean War baby boom, so lots and lots and lots of kids, 70 kids to a class, 70 little boys, one textbook. And we would co-teach with our Korean teachers and try to introduce a methodology that was aimed at actually learning a little bit of the language, which mm-hmm. was a fairly new notion in those days, rather than just studying for the exam.
And for your training, were you still of the generation of Peace Corps where you did training outside of the host country?
Alas, no. When we were very envious of our, in Korean we call them our sunbae, our predecessors, who trained in Brattleboro, Vermont, in Hilo, Hawaii. We thought that all sounded pretty great. Mm-hmm. But no, our group met up in San Francisco. We went to a U.S. military facility to get a lot of inoculations. And we all got on a plane and we flew to Seoul. And at that time, to get to Seoul, we flew from San Francisco to Hawaii. I remember one person on the plane in my group crying. She was from Massachusetts because we were only in Hawaii for about 2 hours. And she couldn't believe she'd flown all the way there and wasn't going to be able to actually experience Hawaii. We flew to Tokyo where we had to overnight just to catch the next plane. And then we got on a plane to Seoul. And of course, it was a different airport we landed at than the airport that a lot of people will know now. So we went to Seoul. We were 2 days in Seoul, where I remember we visited the American Embassy and went to a conference room that is still the conference room at the American Embassy. That's one thing that hasn't changed in Seoul. It's one of the U.S. Embassy is one of the, you know, I would say most anachronistic and out-of-date buildings now in Korea. But in any event, we spent 2 days in Seoul, and then we went down to a provincial town for 10 weeks of language training and preparing for our assignments.
And was there anything that shocked you about Korea when you landed? You had studied Asia. You had an experience in Hong Kong. Did you have any preconceived notions of what you were getting into that were challenged in those initial 10 weeks?
Yes, I absolutely did. I felt I wasn't the only one in my group with some prior experience in Asia. We had other people who'd studied Chinese in Taiwan or studied Japanese or, you know, other kinds of things. I think we were all a little bit shocked. But speaking for myself, I had spent 3 months backpacking in Southeast Asia. I'd spent time in Taiwan. But, you know, we got to Seoul and we all went into this, they were called yogwan, which is the Korean word that said ryokan in Japanese, but mm-hmm. we're not thinking of some nice little place. It was pretty minimalist, very hot. We were there in the summer. There was no air conditioning anywhere. We slept on the floor, which was fine. There was no indoor plumbing and there was no hot water. So the toilets, even in the city at that time, sorry to be a Peace Corps blog, you gotta, gotta talk about toilets.
Of course.
Were holes in the ground.
Yep.
The hygiene was a big issue. Water was not, you were not able to drink it. You would drink a hot barley tea. So yeah, I remember being extremely hot. that sounds a little silly. English was not spoken anywhere, even in Seoul. But it was a city, but it was quite gray and grim, I would say. And when we got to the countryside where, well, it was a town, it was a provincial town where we then also stayed in these little yoguan or sometimes with families, I was surprised by the rigor and the kind of Spartan nature of life. You know, Korea, also, I think, and I'm a girl from Arizona, I'd never lived in a place with four seasons. I mean, it was hot then, it turned really cold in the winter, right? It's like living in Chicago without air conditioning or heat, right? Or indoor plumbing. So yeah, there was a physical discomfort to it, which surprised me. There was not Western food available. You know, Korea obviously had relationship with the United States and there were American troops in South Korea, but we were allowed nowhere near them. So they were not a real presence in our lives. And it had not been a colonial country. So we lived as Koreans, which I think is true in many Peace Corps countries, but there wasn't a sense of a kind of an expat lifestyle.
Yeah.
So it was very challenging. I mean, it was great, you know, but it was much more challenging than I thought it would be, both in a physical sense, but also, as I think many Peace Corps volunteers find, you know, even more challenging is the kind of cross-cultural challenge. And I am and was very tall and I have kind of big blonde hair. But whatever you look like, I mean, you would walk down the street and you would hear continual comments in Korean, which more and more you grew to understand. And this drove people crazy, including me. It was for most people that we met, certainly outside of Seoul, but even then in Seoul, and again, it's changed so much, we were the first foreigner they'd ever seen. So that was wearing. That was wearing. Anyway, I'm going on here too much about all it, but yes, I would say it was very, very challenging. And then I would add to that, that the work culture, I mean, Koreans are something, that, you know, they have a very fierce work culture. And this is not one of the, one of these places where you kind of walk in and say, you know, I come from an American heritage of hard work and, you know, sacrifice. We were softies. So there was a toughness about it and a huge expectation of what we were expected to do. We found out that the way that Peace Corps was translated into Korean, that was pyeongwa pongsa. So pongsa is like service. But Koreans would say to me, well, pongsa literally means like, you know, sacrifice until I die. You know, I mean, the expectations of what we were going to do, I think kind of overwhelmed our young Americans' sort of ideas of what this is going to be like. So it, Korea was at that time considered to be one of the toughest assignments and had a very high termination rate for health reasons. The language is very difficult and the expectations were very high. But for those who stayed and made it through, whether it was, you know, whatever the balance was of satisfaction and frustration, it had, as I think any Peace Corps experience does, but certainly Korea, just a huge, huge impact on all of us.
You do your training, then you go to a village, a town. What was the size of the community that you were working
in? I went to a
in?
County seat.
Okay.
So it was called a gun in Korea. So it was, you know, it's hard to kind of equate these because the infrastructure is so different. But I went to the county seat of a county that in Korea, like in many countries, you kind of, and I still am this way, you don't really say it's how many miles, you say how long it takes to get there. It was about, at that time, it was about a 2.5-3 hour train ride, depending on the kind of train you took. So not very far. I mean, Korea is not a huge country. It's a very mountainous country. I mean, think West Virginia, you know, or I think, are you from Kentucky?
I am from Kentucky.
Maybe parts of Kentucky. Lots and lots of just hills, not like big America, you know, not like Denver where it's flat and then you have the hills come up, but it's continual hills. So if you flatten it all out, it's a pretty big country. And at that time, there was very little infrastructure outside of, but actually a pretty good, I have to say, quite a good train system. That was part of the legacy of the Japanese period. But obviously, much had been destroyed during the war. And although it was 20 years later, yeah, once you got out to the countryside, very few paved roads, and it took a long time to get anywhere. But in any event, I digress. Yes, I was in a county seat. There was one boys' middle school, one girls' middle school, one high school, and then there were little towns and villages around it. So my job in the first year, and this was the way our program was designed after, as I'm sure in any Peace Corps country, after a lot of trial and error, emphasis on the error, the program was I would spend 1 year at my home school, this mm-hmm. boys' middle school, working with the English teachers there, and sometime in teacher training workshops. In the second year, I would travel all around the province, as well as around the whole country to some extent. Now with a year of experience.
You're a professional now, right?
Training all the teachers in Korea. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of the teachers you trained, actually, I mean, they were English teachers, but sometimes they really didn't have an English background.
Yeah.
For example, because of the Japanese colonial heritage, some of the teachers, especially the older male teachers, had taught Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, whoa, you know, you taught one foreign language. We're not teaching Japanese anymore. Teach English. You can imagine it was a very difficult and discomforting thing for them to also have that exposed. They were the senior, you know, more experienced teachers. But in fact, they didn't have the English language qualifications that a younger teacher maybe coming out of teacher training or college now did. So there was a lot of learning about, you know, in a very hierarchical society, true anywhere, but Korea especially.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how to manage that and how to manage that as a young person in a country where, you know, very Confucian, even what they call Neo-Confucian, which mm-hmm. means kind of hyper-Confucian, where the markers of age, gender,
mm-hmm.
education, all those things, family matter so much.
Very, very interesting. And your living situation, were you living with a family on your own, mm-hmm. near a family apartment? What was your house?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, there were no apartments where I lived, and there were no, I don't even think there were, there may have been, I mean, a couple little like two-story structures, you mm-hmm. know, that in the town, but basically everything was kind of one story. And I say that because anybody who's seen Korea now knows that, you know, it's just the land of skyscrapers everywhere mm-hmm. and not just in Seoul. But I had several different living situations, but I lived, as many of us did, in something that was called kind of a hasukjip, which means, I mean, we translate it as boarding house.
Mm-hmm.
So basically you'd rent a room. The room might be about 6 by 8, perhaps. It would have a sort of a really nifty sort of shiny floor on it because the heat came through the floor. It mm-hmm. came from this very low-grade coal that they would have put in there. That was the good news. The bad news is the coal put off carbon monoxide,
yep.
so you had to kind of be careful about that. It would have a little, usually like a maybe a 6 inches by 12 inches kind of little sliding paper window somewhere, and then a kind of a sliding paper door to come in and out onto a kind of a shiny wooden, it's called a maru, sort of, you know, kind of a little porch type thing. But it would be a little room in the house. But even the idea of having a private room was not familiar to Koreans. So they would kind of say, why do you need your own room? So most hasukjip, and mine was the same way, there'd be a family living there,
mm-hmm.
and then they would have rooms that they would rent out to someone who did want their own room, or sometimes it was a couple, you know, and usually those were teachers who were teaching in a different town, or anyone, someone who needed to rent a room, but that's what you rented. With the boarding house came usually 3 meals a day, because remember, they're really not many restaurants around.
Mm-hmm.
There's like, you could get Chinese noodles usually, and we had one Chinese noodle place, and we didn't have a cafeteria at the school. So you would get, they'd serve you breakfast, they'd pack you a little lunch box for lunch, and then you'd have dinner when you got back. And it was always rice and soup and kimchi and a couple of vegetables and maybe some kind of small fish for protein or a little bit of tofu. It all sounds really good now, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was good. And we all grew to love it. But it was very, very challenging for people at first to be faced with rice for morning, noon, and night.
Mm-hmm.
Although actually another interesting cultural thing was Koreans at that time were trying to, and a lot of this is going on in North Korea now, so it's actually really similar. White rice was highly valued, but
mm-hmm.
they didn't produce enough of it. So you had to mix the rice with other grains. Again, that sounds kind of cool to us now, but Koreans hated
it seems very hip.
Yeah, it's very, it seems very hip now. Yeah. I haven't put some beans in there, you
yeah.
know. But to that was like, you know, livestock food. So,
mm-hmm.
and in fact, one of our jobs as teachers was when it was lunchtime, you know, the students, you know, again, these 70 boys in the room, they all sit there because they'd sit in the same desks all day. The teachers moved around because, you know, a lot of kids to move around. So they'd sit there. They'd bring their little lunch boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the Japanese would be bento, but
yep.
it's called toshirak. And they'd open them up and we had to go around and inspect. And if they had, the richer kids, if they had pure white rice in their lunchbox, they were punished for breaking the edict. And 2 days a week, no rice was served at all. And you had to have some other kind of grain to conserve rice. But that actually takes me, I know, to something else, which is a big challenge in the schools, and especially in the boys' schools, in terms of, for me and for everyone, I think, in the Peace Corps, in terms of cultural challenges, and that is corporal punishment was endemic and brutal. And there was usually one teacher, it was often the PE or the anti-communism teacher who was the enforcer. Because again, I wanted to be 70 young boys in a classroom, you know, maintaining order can be difficult. But infractions would lead to much more than paddlings. I mean, serious, very serious beatings. Mm-hmm. And once that practice is there, it does bring out a certain sadistic element to those who may have it. So mm-hmm. that was one of the things that I think for Peace Corps as a whole, we really struggled with, right? Because you know, as a Peace Corps volunteer, you always are coming up, to what extent am I staying true to my own values and to mm-hmm. what extent am I being culturally sensitive? And that was a big struggle, you know, right in front of us, literally right in front of us sometimes in the schools where we worked.
Did you try to confront that, or did Peace Corps at the time give you any tools to confront that? Because teachers for us did have some education of trying to steer them away a little bit from that corporal punishment system.
Right. Yes, volunteers would talk about it with staff, would try to come up with strategies. Some volunteers actually moved if they were in a school where it was particularly difficult and where they had their own, it depended on their relationship with the teachers and their principals and vice principals as well. I do think that maybe having volunteers in the schools overall kind of helped to modulate it a mm-hmm. little bit. And some, I felt like maybe that was the case in my school. But I also think realistically from my own experience and that of, and it wasn't too bad in the school where I was. Maybe people say, I say not too bad, and people say, well, there's zero tolerance. There shouldn't be any. So mm-hmm. you already see the kind of judgment I'm making on that. And others would have others. But I hope we had an impact over time. And certainly, again, I'm not saying this is the Peace Corps at all. Certainly now in South Korea, the whole issue of corporal punishment is, whether it's in schools or in the military, where it was also, you know, extremely harsh, or in the jails and police stations is, I mean, where we call it torture, mm-hmm. is completely transformed. And I mean, that's another story, which is not my Peace Corps story. But when I did become a political officer in Seoul later in the 1980s as a young diplomat, my experience of what physical punishment was, mm-hmm. The role it played in Korean life, helped inform the way that I approached and I kind of advised at the embassy to approach these issues of torture mm-hmm. and human rights that we were confronted with. And these are certainly issues that continue to be germane in North Korea.
And then outside being a teacher, Peace Corps, at least my service and yeah. everybody I've talked to, a lot of downtime.
Yeah.
How did you spend your downtime in your community?
Yeah. Well, I read a lot of books. Mm-hmm. I tried to study Korean. I got on buses and I went places. Again, this is a place where at this point, I mean, no private cars, but a pretty good, you know, kind of bus system and train system, and traveling around for these seminars that we would teach. And so, and it was a little bit lonely. I was the only foreigner in the town. So mm-hmm. a lot of time on weekends, although we taught on Saturdays too, and we were expected. So we didn't have a lot of downtime, but we would find excuses, right? Mm-hmm. And again, I say we in our different towns to travel or get together. And I have to say that, I mean, our Korean friends who are usually fellow teachers and others that we met sometimes, and our students as well, Koreans love the outdoors. The mountains are really beautiful. So there was a lot of reforestation going on. We go hiking a lot. They love to go to the beach. You know, we don't think of Korea, I think, as, mm-hmm. as well. Now President Trump does when he talks about the beach condos in North Korea. Sorry, I keep coming back to the present here. But it is a peninsula. There's a lot mm-hmm. of water. And it's quite beautiful. So mostly you travel around. I wrote a lot of letters. I think that's the other thing you'll find as you talk to older volunteers is that almost all of them will now find maybe their parents or their loved ones, whoever it was, has a big stack of airgrams, you know, mm-hmm. may not even know what airgrams are, right?
But only from this podcast. That's
right.
That's how I know what they are.
Exactly. So, you know, you'd have this big stack. I mean, every country in the world had them as part of the International Postal Union or something, mm-hmm. but, you know, very lightweight little blue thing. But you could write 1,000 words if you wrote small on these things, or maybe more, and you could write full letters too, but these are like pre-stamped. So as I was starting to say, I think you'll find older volunteers, and I noticed in my case too, I mean, I found when I went home and my parents, they still had a whole box with maybe, I don't know, you know, 100 airgrams in them mm-hmm. With incredible detail, you know, things I've completely forgotten about daily life, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what we did. I did taekwondo. I was the only woman in the town to do taekwondo, and mm-hmm. Which is a Korean sport, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was really fun. It was hard, though, because not only was I a foreigner, but I was a woman. So, like the other young men in the taekwondo class refused to spar with me because mm-hmm. they found it just too bizarre. So I could only spar with, I wasn't very good at it, but I mean, I was actually pretty good with the instructor, you know, so it's a little awkward. I mean, there are those things, but that's a gender thing as well.
Mm-hmm. Did you happen to continue your practice post Peace Corps service, or that was the end of it?
I didn't, but I can show you a picture later. I saw my teacher again when I was back as ambassador, and he's still teaching, and that was lovely to see him. No, I didn't continue that, but I did, you know, I did continue to hike, and I played a lot of tennis. You know, I mean, sports were definitely a thing that you could do, and that helped. But then the other thing I did, and this is I pretended. I told people I was studying for the Foreign Service exam because one thing it gives you standing in Korea is to say you're studying for an exam. You know, this is a country where then and now, I mean, people spend like literally 5 years preparing for a what they call the koshi, the higher civil servant exam, right? That's the old Confucian tradition. So, you know, if you're sitting in the way schools are set up in Korea, or were set up in those days, as I said, students all stay in their classroom, and there's a place called the teacher's room. And it's not the place where you go and you have your coffee. It's where you have a desk and you're all lined up with the vice principal at the front. Mm-hmm. And you're supposed to be there from before the vice principal gets there until he leaves. So that's why. So that's like 7 in the morning until maybe like 8 or 9 at night. And, you know, no one has all that much to do. And it's kind of cold in there, too. So you bring in your books. You bring in. But I just brought in whatever books. And I said, I'm studying for the diplomatic exam, which covered pretty much anything since.
Yeah. Which you did take. Because in reading your bio, I was very surprised that you went from Peace Corps service and then a year later, you were in the Foreign Service.
Yeah. And I didn't even really know about the Foreign Service, but it does sound very sort of opportunistic, I suppose. But at that time, the Foreign Service exam, I think it's a little bit different now, like everything, but it's given once a year, number 2 pencil, and, you know, fill in the little things. But if you're abroad, it's at the U.S. Embassy. So it was on a Saturday in December. And I still remember I went up to the vice principal and I asked permission to miss class on Saturday, and actually part of Friday, too, so I could go up and take the exam. And I'd practice my Korean to say this, you know. And he responded to me in his totally Korean way. He said, are you prepared for it? You know. Are you going to pass it? I said, well, you know, I'd say, you know, you can only go if you're sure you're going to pass it. So, but yeah, I went up to take the Foreign Service exam, and I did pass it, and I had to come back, and that took a year or so to actually come back and take the oral exam. I mean, on paper, with the passage of time, it all seems very smooth, but I mean, I'd want to reassure any young people out there. I didn't feel that way at the time. I mean, I finished my Peace Corps service in 1977. I had no idea if I was going to get hired. Should I go to graduate school? What should I do? So there was all of that. And a number of people in my group did stay on for a third year in the Peace Corps. I did not stay on for a third year, but in my second year, the other thing I did is I did start to work a bit on the training programs. And I would say, it's still kind of hard for me to admit it now, but I would say that was another way I think I addressed the loneliness of being there, you know, and it was kind of lonely. I mean, obviously now I appreciate, as I did then, the purity of the experience of being in this small place. And that's the most important part. But it's a hard thing to sustain through these kind of long winters. And being able to do things like work on the training programs was very helpful.
We've told us a lot about your service, but do you have a particular story that you found yourself maybe telling over and over again, or something that's very iconic or memorable, one of these memories that is just fun for you to share?
Well, see, I've told you a couple of things, but they tend to be maybe a little bit more on the serious side. I'd say one thing that was probably more striking about being in the Peace Corps in Korea as opposed probably to some other countries is the very, very sharp differences in the gender roles and how that played out in terms of kind of, well, what you were allowed to do. Maybe that's not so unusual. But in any event, in Korea, I think that male and female volunteers had very different experiences. For example, drinking culture and going out was very much a part of what male volunteers did because that's what Korean men did, and it was just expected. On the other hand, young single women were expected not to go out at all, and indeed really not to venture out by themselves anywhere. So some accommodations were obviously made or had to be made for the fact that American women just weren't going to live that way. And I made lovely friends of all genders, but it always drove me a little bit crazy, I have to say, when I would, on the rare occasion when, say, all the teachers would be out on a picnic. We'd like to take picnics. So all the teachers would go out on a picnic, and the men would bring out the drink, whether it was beer or something called makgeolli, or things that, because of, you know, K-pop were probably known, soju and mm-hmm. different things. Didn't have all that variety then, but certainly always something to drink. And in a show of great beneficence, I guess, would say, would you like something? Because women were never offered anything. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, yes, please. And they would get out the beer, and they would bring out a cup that was like, it would hold like a, you know, some kind of soju or something, mm-hmm. and literally pour like a quarter of an ounce.
So you're getting less than a shot of
less
beer.
Less than a shot. And it was like a really big deal. They'd make a really big deal of it. So maybe that's not the most interesting story to tell, but
I think it's very telling of the culture, and I think volunteers still today deal with that a little bit, maybe a little bit less. And mm-hmm. we sort of called it the third sex. There was male, female, and then expat females.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
They got to sort of weave in and out of both of them. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I felt a little jealous because I couldn't do a lot of the things with the women
that
female volunteers could do. But they seem to be able to, at least every now and then, have that little shot of beer.
No, I think, and actually I would say there are ways, is even more than now and then, and maybe that's why I emphasize like certain activities, like, mm-hmm. you know, if you do taekwondo, even though there's, or you play tennis, or you go hiking, and again, something like hiking is a little more neutral. It does kind of open up, and there's much more space to interact very freely, and maybe I'll tell you, again, this is not really a story, but maybe this is an insight into Korean culture, which maybe you don't want. But so in our language training, mm-hmm. we only had 10 weeks to learn the basics of what is considered to be, and I believe to be, for English speakers, the most or one of the most difficult languages in the world to speak well. It's very hard. But the Peace Corps had discovered something incredibly useful. And that was that there were kind of two things that we needed to do before we went out to our sites. I don't know if you still call them sites, mm-hmm. but to our assignments. And the first may seem really odd, and that is to give a public speech in Korean mm-hmm. without notes. So we all had to memorize these speeches because Korea, this is what prepared me to be ambassador, you see. Korea is a very speech-giving, ceremonial kind of culture. So we memorized these speeches, which were very simple, but basically said, you know, with all the honorifics to everybody, I'm glad mm-hmm. to be here and I'll do my best and so on. And I remember climbing up to the platform to give that speech when I arrived at my school in September 1975. And these 3,000 they weren't so little, but junior high school boys all lined up in military fashion, essentially in military uniforms. They all wore uniforms with their teachers standing at attention while the principal introduced me. And then getting up to give the speech, and, you know, it was kind of the classic thing with the microphone that's going, you know, and I realized that I was way up on this platform, and I was wearing a dress that was probably several inches shorter than Korean women at that time wore, and, you know, so anyway, but I got up there and I gave this speech, and I could see all these students, these boys standing at attention, and they'd all start giggling, and the teachers were walking up and down the line to the students, hitting them, to stand at attention, to stay in order. So that was really painful for me, and because I wanted to laugh or say stop or something, but anyway, I did it. But years later, when I went back as ambassador and had all these kind of, you know, down memory lane experiences, I talked to one of those students who'd been in that line, and actually it was something like that. I said, oh, I remember when I had to give that speech on the first day, and you know, in Korean, and it was so hard. And he said, you were speaking in Korean? I said, we thought that was English. But the second part, so that's that story. But the second part of what the Peace Corps, it was a great language program, said we needed to do in our 10 weeks is learn the answer to 20 questions. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is a little bit true in other countries, but Koreans then, a little bit less so now, they will ask you what for us are the nosiest questions. Mm-hmm. But they're always exactly the same questions.
Yep.
Right. So, and you can probably guess what some of them are, but they are, in addition to, you know, what's your name and whatnot, mm-hmm. how old are you? Mm-hmm. You know, what's your family composition? Mm-hmm. Are you married?
Yep.
why aren't you married? How much do you make? Mm-hmm. Right. And then there was, what are your hobbies? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were 20, and if you had those, you found you could carry on a conversation with anybody, mm-hmm. right? So that's another lesson I kind of took into my diplomatic life, although there are different questions in different countries. And mm-hmm. yeah, I found maybe as I kind of rose in status too, that people weren't so openly nosy, right? Life changed a little bit, but those 20 questions are... And then, of course, I found I became so Koreanized, I started asking Koreans the same questions, which they liked. Mm-hmm. Except now when I meet Koreans, the society's changed, and they look at me like...
You're
nosy. You know, I'm this. Yeah, well, a little bit like, yeah, you're not really supposed to ask. I know people ask people what their salaries are, although that's a little more acceptable in Korea. But, you know, mm-hmm. where is your hometown? You know, it used to be that was the first question you asked Koreans, where is your hometown? Now I ask a Korean, where is your hometown? They all look at me like I'm crazy. Well, it's Seoul, of course. We're all from Seoul.
You left Peace Corps. You had passed the Foreign Service exam. Did you think that you would ever end up back in Korea? When you were leaving, or maybe that was your desire, you wanted to come back.
So I entered the Foreign Service in 1978. I definitely wanted to go to Asia. Mm-hmm. I was very interested in going to China, but we only normalized relations with China in 1978. I say only because it sounds like yesterday to me. I know it's a long time ago now. And I did serve in China for 2 years, and then I went to Korea. I had some Korean language, and it was actually pretty good by that time. Mm-hmm. So no, I did want to go to Korea, and I thought having the Korean language would be a boost because there weren't many people mm-hmm. other than former Peace Corps volunteers who spoke it. But I had a terrible time getting my assignment in Korea because I wanted to go as a political officer, and the ambassador there at that time said there'd never been a woman as a political officer. This is the American embassy, mm-hmm. and the Koreans would never accept it, and he wasn't going to take a woman as a political officer. But I went, and because I think because of my Peace Corps experience, honestly, and because of my language foundation, which I built on by doing the State Department program, mm-hmm. Because I did know kind of a little bit more about Korean life from the inside, I turned out to be pretty effective at that job, which was following these extraordinary, political changes that were going on in Korea by the time I was back there in the 80s. Mm-hmm. All the things that I was told to avoid in the 70s, I could dive into them. So, yeah, I was very happy to do that. But then I left Korea. I was there 6 years at that time, because if you do speak Korean in the State Department, there's not that many places you go. Mm-hmm. And so much was happening. This was the period of street protests leading to direct election of the president, the Seoul Olympics, and lots of drama with North Korea as well, of course. But I left in 89, and I didn't go back to Korea for another 16 or 17 years. And so coming back to be ambassador in Korea many years later, in 2008, really is a kind of a full circle and something I always felt throughout my Foreign Service career, the only place I actually really wanted to be ambassador was in Korea, because mm-hmm. it was a place where I felt like, one, I could make a difference. I could do something that, I brought a certain advantage to it, if you like. Mm-hmm. It took a long time to convince people of that, but I thought that I did. And two, I was so affected by Korea's extraordinary journey. I went to Korea in 1975 at a time when its GDP per capita, however you measure that, was less than North Korea's, was less than the Philippines, was less than most of the countries where Peace Corps had Peace Corps at that time. Mm-hmm. And, I went back at a time in the 80s when it turned from essentially a military authoritarian rule to democracy. Mm-hmm. And I went back as ambassador at a time when, again, I don't, GDP per capita is not the best way, but where it was, 11th, 12th largest economy in the world, mm-hmm. It created a lifetime of stimulation and inspiration and reflection for me. And the kind of lessons that I drew then that I draw now from Korea are ones that really influenced, I think, my diplomatic career in other places, as well as my thinking about our own country and about our own role in the world and where we can have some influence and where we have limits. Also, the positive and the negatives of those. And again, I think those are probably very typical of Peace Corps experiences, I would feel, because my experience is Korea. And because I've been lucky enough to have now this cycle of over 40 years, that it has been incredibly enriching to me. I think I've been very lucky just to have been in a country that has been through this kind of transformation and where there's still so much to do.
A lot of my listeners are current Peace Corps volunteers or recently returned Peace Corps volunteers, and I know that a lot of them dream of being in the Foreign Service and mm-hmm. continuing their service abroad in some capacity, but mm-hmm. a very different capacity. Do you have any words of wisdom for someone now starting out where you were back in 1978?
Yeah. The tradition of the Foreign Service, which I worry sometimes has become a little bit diluted, but the tradition of the Foreign Service reflects or should reflect a lot of the values that I think reflect the Peace Corps, that you know, you're not going to have good policy, you're not going to have good results unless you have people who really have spent the time and committed themselves to an understanding of the culture, language, history, context of the areas in which we are engaged. And so I do think that the Peace Corps is an extraordinary preparation for diplomacy. And maybe not even know, but because I think there is a sense in this country now that we need to strengthen a diplomatic muscle. And by diplomatic muscle, I mean some of those qualities I'm talking about that have become somewhat sidelined over the last few years. And I'm not talking only about, you know, the current administration. I think it's something that's been ongoing for some time, that I hope that people who went into the Peace Corps, you know, for some of the reasons I've suggested, will take that same kind of commitment and perspective into diplomatic careers.
Well, thank you. Well, I've enjoyed spending some time with you, learning about your Peace Corps service, some of the work that you've done post-Peace Corps. For anybody who's interested in learning a little bit more about you and what you're currently doing now, leading the Korean Economic Institute, where can they find out more information about that?
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I am now back in Washington, D.C. I've retired from the Foreign Service as of several years ago. And yes, I lead something called the Korea Economic Institute of America. There is a website. We do podcasts too. So that's certainly a place to look for information about Korea. It would also, I think, push our Friends of Korea group, which has a website. Korea, as far as I know, and you may be able to correct me if I'm wrong, Korea is the only country that has invited former volunteers back on expense-paid reunion trips for the last decade or so. There's another one going in, like, I think next month in the fall. And I saw a number of these groups come back while I was ambassador in Korea. Mm-hmm. So I would suggest people look at the Friends of Korea site. You'll see, you can hear there's the Museum of Contemporary Korean History in Seoul, which also has a website, has taken oral histories of former Peace Corps volunteers in Korea, along with much of our memorabilia and those aerograms I talked about. The University of Southern California has digitalized a lot of Peace Corps volunteer Korea memorabilia and letters and journals. So, yeah, we're kind of proud of the fact that, that in a way, we had, there was the Korean War, but we had this experience of Korea some years later that is an important part of the history of Korea. So all those things we hung on to for all those years are finding a home somewhere else. So, but yes, anyone who wants to contact me at KEI can find us online and come to some of our programs if you're in Washington.
Yeah, and I'll include links in the show notes at mypeacecorpsstory.com so everybody can find you. But it has been a pleasure speaking with you today.
Thank you. Thanks so much, and thanks for this great project you're doing.